made the outline which was passed on across the centuries and to which different men added as they developed the theme under this general outline that somebody like Moses had produced to begin with. Nothing like that. What it demands is that there must have been an intelligent cause, an intelligent supervisor who existed for 1400 years to supervise the development of this book so that it maintained this unity and moved to the conclusion which characterizes the book of Revelation. And what intelligent cause, what intelligent supervisor existed for 1400 years except God himself? So that this book gives evidence in its remarkable unity of having come not from man, but through man, from God. God alone is 1,500 years old. God alone could have done it. I think the unity of the book is a tremendous argument for the divine origin of the book. Let me move on to talk about what I think is the strongest and most convincing proof that this book is from God. And that's the proof of fulfilled prophecy. Predictions that you find in this book that have already been fulfilled. Not predictions that were made simply a year or 6 months before they came to pass. Not a Gene Dixon type of prediction that maybe comes to pass and maybe doesn't. Not the kind of prediction that could be based upon a careful and alert studying of developing world trends so that you could say, I see it coming because I see the way things are moving. Not that kind of prediction. But predictions that are made hundreds of years before it comes to pass or before the fulfillment. Predictions that deal not simply with general trends, but with specific details and yet which come to fulfillment. Not simply one or two, but dozens of predictions that have already found their fulfillment. And I only have time tonight to single out two or three. In the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 28, we have a remarkable account of what would happen to the people of Israel if they should obey God. And what would happen to them if they did not follow God as their Lord? In Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 15, we read, It shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all the commandments and his statutes which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. And then you have a list of the curses. Cursed shalt thou be in the city, and cursed shalt thou be in the field, and on down through the list. The curses that were going to come upon Israel if they would not obey God. And you jump down with me to verse 49. And you'll notice that there Moses says, God says through Moses, The Lord shall bring a nation against thee from far, from the end of the earth, as swift as the eagle flieth, a nation whose tongue thou shalt not understand, a nation of fierce countenance which shall not regard the person of the old, nor show favor to the young, and he shall eat the fruit of thy cattle and the fruit of thy land until thou be destroyed, which also shall not leave thee either corn, wine, or oil, or the increase of thy kine, or flocks of thy sheep, until he have destroyed thee. And he shall besiege thee in all thy gates, until thy high and fenced walls come down, wherein thou trustest throughout all the land. And he shall besiege thee in all thy gates throughout all thy land, which the Lord thy God hath given thee. And then something that's not very pleasant, but most significant. And thou shalt eat the fruit of thine own body, the flesh of thy sons and of thy daughters, which the Lord thy God hath given thee in the siege and in the straitness, wherewith thine enemies shall distress thee. So that the man that is tender among you, that is sort of tender-hearted and kind of weak as far as his stomach is concerned, and very delicate, his eyes shall be evil toward his brother, toward the wife of his bosom, and toward the remnant of his children which he shall leave, so that he will not give to any of them of the flesh of his children whom he shall eat, because he hath nothing left him in the siege, and so on. But the horrible picture is that fathers and mothers would eat their own children because they were besieged in the city and because food had given out. Now we have the fulfillment of that recorded for us in the wars of the Jews by the Jewish historian Josephus, who wrote in the 90s, about A.D. 90. And he tells the stomach-upsetting story of mothers cooking their children and hiding the flesh of those children so that they wouldn't share it with anybody else. This took place when Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 A.D. Let's read on in this passage. We come to verse 63, and then on to the end of the chapter. And here we have something that has found its fulfillment across the centuries and in our lifetime. Verse 63 says, "And it shall come to pass that as the Lord rejoiced over you to do good and to multiply you, so the Lord will rejoice over you to destroy you and to bring you to naught, and you shall be plucked from off the land whither thou goest to possess it. And the Lord will scatter thee among all the people from the one end of the earth even unto the other. And there thou shalt serve other gods, which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, even wood and stone. And among these nations shalt thou find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest. But the Lord shall give thee there a trembling heart, and failing of eyes, and sorrow of mind. And thy life shall hang in doubt before thee, and thou shalt fear day and night, and shalt have none assurance of thy life. In the morning thou shalt say, Would God it were even. And at even thou shalt say, Would God it were morning. For the fear of thine heart wherewith thou shalt fear, and for the sight of thine eyes which thou shalt see." Here Moses says, years and years before it even began to take place, God will scatter you to every nation under the sun. And there you will be persecuted, there you will be tortured, so that when morning comes you'll say, I wish it were night, I wish I didn't have to put up with the things I'm going to have to put up with today, to suffer the things I'm going to have to suffer today. And when evening comes, you'll say, I wish it were morning, because then the sufferings of the night would be over. Go back with me to Nazi Germany and think of what happened to Jews in that nation. Jews in the prison camps. Jews that were killed in the gas furnaces of those concentration camps. And you find the fulfillment of this passage. Look at every nation under the sun today. At every city where there is commerce being carried on. And there you find Jews today in fulfillment of this passage. And the remarkable thing is, they're still in existence today. And that's something, too, that the Old Testament predicted. Nation after nation, with far less misuse and abuse, has passed out of existence through the years, but the Jewish nation has been kept, preserved, as a nation intact, scattered everywhere upon the face of the earth. Somebody asked an emperor years ago, can you give me one proof that the Bible is true? And the answer that came back from the man of God that stood before him was this: the Jew. And of course, wrapped up in all of that is what the Bible predicts about the Jew. Or let me turn you to another passage quickly, Ezekiel chapter 26. This 26th chapter of Ezekiel talks about what was going to happen to the city of Tyre, which is located over in ancient Phoenicia on the seacoast of the Mediterranean, just north of the land of Israel. And here in Ezekiel chapter 26, you will notice that in verse 7 it says, "For thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I will bring upon Tyrus Nebuchadrezzar, king of Babylon, the king of kings from the north, with horses and with chariots and with horsemen and companies and with much people. And he shall slay with the sword thy daughters in the field, and he shall make a fort against thee, and case a mount against thee, and lift up the buckler against thee. And he shall set engines of war against thy walls, and with his axes he shall break down thy towers. By reason of the abundance of his horses, their dust shall cover thee. Thy walls shall shake at the noise of the horsemen and of the wheels of the chariots when he shall enter into thy gates, and men enter into the city wherein is made a breach. With the hoofs of his horses he shall tread down all thy streets, and he shall slay thy people by the sword and make strong garrisons, and strong garrisons shall go down to the ground." Now here the name of the conqueror is given, Nebuchadnezzar. Ezekiel wrote just a few years before Nebuchadnezzar came and did destroy the city of Tyre. The city of Tyre, located on the seacoast, and I don't know if I have enough space here, maybe I do, to demonstrate it, but it's located on the seacoast, when Nebuchadnezzar came against the city of Tyre, he surrounded it. There was no place for them to go except to the sea, And so you have something like a situation like this, the city of Tyre here. And so what happened was that the people moved out to a little island out here just off the seacoast. And Nebuchadnezzar simply leveled the old city of Tyre to the ground, left it there, the rubble on the seacoast, and went his way. Something like 200 years, over 200 years later, about 332 or 33, Alexander the Great came down that seacoast. He had come across Asia Minor, fighting decisive battles. He came to the site of ancient Tyre. And he said to those people out on the island, "You must surrender or I will come and destroy you." And they thought, we're safe out here. We're surrounded by water. He can't touch us. But they didn't reckon with the ability of that young man, Alexander. For he took the remains of the ancient city, scraped them into the water, and built himself a causeway, a passage out to the island. So that what you had, of course, was a roadway out here. That changed the shape of the seacoast. And today the seacoast comes something like this, because the sand is washed in and you no longer have just a narrow causeway, but you have sort of a peninsula sticking out there today where the ancient city of Tyre was. But he took the ruins of the city, scraped them into the sea, and thereby captured the new city of Tyre on that island. Now look with me at verse 12. He says here, and bear in mind, this is over 200 years before it happened, "And they shall make a spoil of thy riches, and make a prey of thy merchandise, and they shall break down thy walls, and destroy thy pleasant houses." Nebuchadnezzar did that. "And they shall lay thy stones, and thy timber, and thy dust in the midst of the water." That part of the prophecy was fulfilled 200 years after Nebuchadnezzar's time. Now I challenge Gene Dixon to give us that kind of a prediction which can be fulfilled with that kind of exactness. It goes on to say in verse 13, "And I will make the cause of the noise of thy sounds, thy songs to cease, and the sound of thy harps be heard no more. And I will make thee like the top of a rock, just as flat as can be, and thou shalt be a place to spread nets upon." When I took New Testament, no, it was biblical archaeology, under Dr. Free at Wheaton College, how long ago? 25 years ago. Dr. Free showed us pictures of that ancient site of Tyre, just as flat as can be. And what do you think was taking place on that site? Hanging there, blowing in the wind, drying, were fishermen's nets. Not because some Christians decided they wanted to fulfill the Old Testament, but in ignorance, fishermen had hung their nets there to dry, and it's exactly what it says. It'll be a place to dry nets, so that you have the fulfillment taking place even within our day. That's the kind of prediction which you have in Scripture. That's the kind of fulfillment which is given to us as history develops. Let me mention just one other item. You know that Christmas verse, Micah chapter 5, verse 2. "Thou, Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be least among the thousands of Judah, yet from thee, from out of thee shall come forth him that shall be ruler of my people Israel." That's the verse that the rabbis quoted to Herod the Great when he said, "Where is the Christ going to be born?" They said, "In Bethlehem, because this is what the prophet Micah has said." The place of the birth of Jesus, pinpointed 700 years before he was born. Now, if I were going to pick a place for the birth of the Messiah, I wouldn't have picked that little dumpy town of Bethlehem. I would have picked Jerusalem, the city of the great king, the capital of Israel. That would be the place to have the Messiah born. But it wasn't so. Micah said, "It'll be Bethlehem." And when you stop to think what God did to bring about the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem instead of up in Nazareth, you will see how much more remarkable is the prediction of Micah. For Mary and Joseph lived in Nazareth, and the only reason they happened to be in Bethlehem when Jesus was born was that the Roman government had decided to take a census in preparation for a taxation. And apparently in the land of Palestine, to sort of cater to the Jewish people, because they rebelled against this kind of thing, there was a special arrangement made that everybody should go back to his old hometown, the town of his forefathers. And of course the Jews gloried in their forefathers. And that's why it was that Mary and Joseph had to go back to Bethlehem. That was the town of David. And they were there registering in the census when Mary gave birth to Jesus. So God moved an empire to set up a taxation. And God moved a local governor to arrange a special situation where people had to go back to the town of their forefathers to register, in order to fulfill that prophecy made by Micah 700 years before Jesus was born, in which he pinpointed that little village as the place of the birth of the Messiah. This is the reason why I believe that the book, the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament alike, is from God. No human mind is capable of this kind of prediction. God alone could have given this book. And so you see, when I take my Bible to read it, I take it to read it with this confidence that when I hear it, when I read it, it isn't simply Ezekiel or Moses or Paul that speaks to me. God talks to me. This is the Word of God, God's message to me. And when I think of what God has done to give me this book, and then to preserve it across the centuries, I can't help but feel a sense of high privilege and a sense of pride. This is my book. God has preserved it for me. This is your book. God has gone to tremendous lengths to give to you and to me and to preserve for us this wonderful book. We ought never to be ashamed of it. We ought never to feel that we should apologize for it. But we ought always to carry it and to use it with a high sense of gratitude and praise to God for what He's done in giving us the Bible. And beyond that, we ought to use it. Consider the investment that God has made in giving this book to us. Men have given their lives in the production and in the preservation of this book. I think of William Tyndale, who determined he was going to put this book in the English language and print the New Testament in English. And he had to flee from England because they would have taken his life there. And he succeeded in translating the New Testament and getting it printed in English, having it printed behind drawn shades at night. And it was shipped in bales of clothing and merchandise into England to get it in. And finally, through some treachery on the part of some printers, he was apprehended, put in prison, burned at the stake. And as he was there at the stake and the flame was being lighted, he prayed, "Lord, open the eyes of the King of England." That was less than 100 years before the time of King James, 1611, when our authorized version was produced. God answered his prayer, but think of the price that was paid as that man's life went up in smoke, burned at the stake. God has made tremendous investment in this book that you and I may have it. How ashamed we ought to be of ourselves for not using it more than we do. For our own benefit, for our own growth, for our own development. And for not propagating it more than we do. Taking it to others. Taking its message to others. What a privilege it is to be the people of the book. This has been a long discussion. You've been very attentive, and I don't think anybody's asleep. At least if you are, you're sleeping with your eyes open. If I have raised some questions in your mind, and you'd like to...